Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And joining us now with his book, American Politics on the Rocks, contributing to Overnight America on Monday nights, Rich Rubino, thank you for coming back on.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
I love these different facts you have in the book, and I like that you're able to refer to history so easily. I don't know what kind of brain you're walking around with, but man, that's like a computer, the things you're able to recall.
So well, my short-term memory is not very good, though.
Oh, but the long-term memory, you got that down. All right, so
different part of the brain, I guess.
American Politics on the Rocks, The Bizarre Side of American Politics. We saw a lot of talk this week about the squad. So President Trump tweeting over the weekend, and then you had the squad getting together earlier today to hold a press conference. And what's interesting about that, it's not that this is necessarily unique, because you've seen a lot of instances where there are different people within a political party that may disagree with its leadership, in this case, Nancy Pelosi, but at the same time, they're also disagreeing with the presidency because they're of the opposite party, which doesn't necessarily make them a lone island. But I wanted to talk to you about some of those instances you've seen in the past and how those were resolved.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the parties are actually more homogenous, I think, than they've probably ever been. If you look at the score, there used to be liberal Republicans and liberal Democrats that would oftentimes get together. And then on the conservative side, there was what was called the conservative coalition. So on the Democratic side, you had Southern Democrats, and you had conservative Southern Democrats, who were basically Democrats based on heritage more than anything else. And then you had Western Republicans like Barry Goldwater in Arizona. And sometimes they would get together. So, political parties weren't necessarily based on ideology. They were almost based on, in terms of who's going to get the perks, who's going to get the jobs. But it was very hard to keep the parties together. And oftentimes you would have conservative Democrats, for example, supporting Republican presidents. I mean, go back to Nixon, and when they were trying to figure out how many votes he had to withstand impeachment and then to potentially withstand it in conviction, they were looking. And two of Nixon's most loyal supporters, for example, were James Eastland from Mississippi, was recently in the news because, Joe Biden had said that he had worked with him and kind of, was laudatory toward him on other issues other than segregation. But he was just a steadfast arch segregationist. And he had John Stennis from Mississippi, also a supporter of President Nixon. But then, on the other side of the aisle, you had folks like Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland. His father was one of the first to call for impeachment for the Watergate hearings. He was a more or less moderate to liberal Republican. So what you have now is the parties are very ideologically homogenous. Now, the squad is four members. Now, there are four members, all who are elected in predominantly Democratic districts where there's basically the only possible way they could lose would be in a primary. Mm-hmm. You look at AOC's congressional district, for example, it went 58 points against President Trump. Ayanna Pressley beat Mike Capuano, one of the most liberal members of the House, by running to his left. So they're basically liberal members of the House, and they have nothing to gain by moving to the center. Mm-hmm. By moving to the center, like a lot of members, if they try to move to the center, at least portray themselves as a centrist in the general election because they're worried about a Republican, or for that matter, a Republican might try to run to the left. They're worrying about a Democrat, but all they have to worry about, as I say, is somebody on their left in a primary, so they can move as far left as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, on the Republican side, we've seen similar recently, for example. Ron Paul from Texas ran for president in 2008, 2012. He was called Dr. No because he was a doctor, first of all. And secondly, there would be resolutions, and he would vote no. He would vote no. Sometimes it would be 434-1. And he was an arch constitutionalist, and he said if the Constitution does not specifically state something, then he would be voting against it. For example, congressional gold medals. Mm-hmm. Congressional gold medals, which are essentially awarded to Americans like, for example, Rosa Parks, for example, or Americans who have done outstanding things. He would vote against those because he said the Congress doesn't specifically authorize that. there are congressmen now like Thomas Massey, for example, from Kentucky, who's very similar in that respect. Yeah. He's often votes no, and there's also a possibility that he might have a primary opposition because he's more of a constitutionalist. And his job, he doesn't necessarily see it as trying to get largesse for his congressional district. And a lot of these members are, it used to be, there are two groups in the party. There's the Republican Assemblies, which is a conservative bloodline of the party, and there's also the Republican, and then there's the Republican Study Group, and they're also very conservative members of the party, and they actually worked against John Boehner when John Boehner would try to get legislation, for example, for the debt to pay off the, to raise the debt limit.
Yeah.
It was the conservative Republicans who would say no, and eventually John Boehner, you know, eventually when he left, he basically called them anarchists. When he left the speakership and said that, you know, he couldn't get much done because of this factionalism in his own party. And certainly Paul Ryan saw this as well. You know, he was forced to pull legislation supported by Donald Trump that would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act because they were more conservative than anything that Trump would propose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you have in current times. But it's interesting because you go back in history, on the Republican side, you always had the progressive bloodline of the party.
Yeah.
Of course, the Republican Party, as I often say, began as a more liberal party than the Democrats. The Democrats were the more conservative party. But throughout most of the 1900s, you had progressives. In 1912, for example, Theodore Roosevelt ran in the Republican primaries. This is the first year that the Republican primaries were really actualized. He lost in the Republican primaries. They went to the convention. I mean, he won more delegates in the primaries than William Howard Taft, the incumbent president, the conservative, more conservative than Roosevelt. So Roosevelt then bolted the party, said, "I'm throwing my hat in the ring," that's the expression came, and ran as what was called the Progressive Party, or the Bull Moose Party.
Right.
And that year he split the vote with Taft, and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, eventually won. But it's interesting because that was the Progressive Party was always kind of, that there was always that progressive wing in the Republican Party that was very liberal. And they also, though, had conservatives, like, for example, Joe Cannon, the Speaker of the House, back in the early 1900s, Republican from Arizona, and he was always having problems with both Theodore Roosevelt when he was president. I mean, you know, they were the two bloodlines. Cannon was, you know, an arch conservative, and Roosevelt a steadfast progressive, and they were always having an internecine battle. And it's interesting because if you look at it, for example, in 1924, this all kind of came to a head between the conservatives and the moderates.
Mm-hmm.
And that year, so just for some background, in 1923, Calvin Coolidge assumes the presidency after the death of Warren G. Harding. Coolidge is basically a laissez-faire Republican. Interestingly, because in terms of Coolidge, when he was governor of Massachusetts, he actually instituted a lot of liberal platforms, liberal policies, but he said when he was governor, for example, increased education funding. When he said when he was president, it was different because he believed those were all state issues. So he was a conservative when it came to being president and dealing with federal issues, but he was more liberal when he was a governor. So that's kind of interesting paradox there. But when he becomes president in 1924, there's a progressive who runs, and his name is Senator Robert La Follette Sr., and they call him Fighting Bob from Wisconsin. And he accepted the nomination of this progressive party, the same party that nominated Theodore Roosevelt. And he actually did extremely well. He only won his own state of Wisconsin, but he garnered 16.6% of the popular vote that year.
Wow.
And believe it or not, there were 12 maverick Republicans, and they stayed in their caucus. They didn't become progressives, but they actually crossed the aisle not to support the Democrat, John W. Davis, but they supported the progressive candidate that year, and they supported La Follette. And they were actually reprimanded by House Speaker Nicholas Longworth, was the House Speaker from Ohio, and he reprimanded that. And what he did, you know, for these mutineers, is that he basically took them off of the committees that they were serving.
Oh,
and
interesting.
he punished them not for anything that they had done, you know, unethical, but because they had not supported in the presidential election their presidential candidate. And there were actually three Republicans in the Senate who actually did the same thing, who supported their candidacy. They both lost their committee assignments. So, you know, he played hardball with that, but they all mostly basically stayed in the Republican Party because there really was no very little of a progressive caucus in that party.
Oh, you know what's interesting? You mentioned the committee part of it. Wasn't Nancy Pelosi, when it comes to the squad, wasn't she giving them more work to do? So it was the opposite approach. She said, okay, you got all this free time. I'm going to put you on to find more work for you to do. Because I remember Ocasio-Cortez was bringing up that she said that Pelosi was giving her busy work because she was being too loud. So it's the opposite approach now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we're in an era where people don't like to. It used to be that people would actually, you know, congressmen would raise their families in Washington, and that was seen as respectable. Now every congressman wants to go home because every time they're in Washington, somebody's going to run against them and say that they're a Washington insider.
Yeah, I don't know about you. All that money you'd be spending to live in Washington, D.C., not to live there would drive me crazy. That's so
much
money.
What they do actually is they give them representational allowances that they can use to try to find places in Washington to live, but also when they go back home, in order for where they can put their district offices, for example. So they get these representation allowances, and, you know, obviously they get free plane travel, and the money that they get actually is contingent upon where they live. For example, if you're representing America Samoa, mm-hmm. You're probably going to have a lot more money because you have to travel out there than somebody who represents, you know, suburban Virginia, for example, suburban
exactly.
Washington.
You know, I got to mention this too, because the Squad, I'm not impressed with that name, but Bull Moose Party, that's an impressive name.
Isn't that a lot more impressive? I mean, Theodore Roosevelt at one point, you know, he was actually shot, and there's actually a picture, you know, his speech. He continued giving the speech when he was running in 1912, and he said, you know, no one can stop me like a bull moose. Like the bull moose, which is one of his favorite animals, and that's kind of where that expression had come from. And because he kind of moved back to the Republican Party, and there was talk he might run in 1916, but he decided against running that year as well. But the Progressive Party has always been around in the Republican ranks, at least during that time period.
He is like a political professor. The guy knows it all and knows his politics. And that's why we like to look at some of the different things that have happened in the past that compares to what's happening now. American Politics on the Rocks, that's the name of his book. Our guest, Rich Rubino, contributing on Mondays. We'll continue with him on Overnight America, KMOX. Who needs to go to college if you're trying to study history when you have these Rich Rubino interviews Monday nights here on KMOX? The guy knows his stuff. We like to talk about some current events and then how do they apply historically to the world of politics. We'll continue our conversation with him. Check out his book, American Politics on the Rocks. Rich Rubino, our guest this hour. One of the more recent rogue ones, too, Justin Amash from Michigan.
Oh, yes. He's fascinating.
Yeah, he made a lot of talk about that. He was very public of the reasons why he's leaving the Republican Party. So it seems like he may be trying to start his own thing, too.
Well, here's the thing with Justin Amash. It's fascinating. So he represents the 1st Congressional District of Michigan, which is actually the Grand Rapids area and some of the environs of Grand Rapids. First of all, it's the same congressional district that Gerald Ford represented.
Mm-hmm.
So it's some interesting parallels between the two, because Ford was actually he's seen as Mr. Establishment, but he was actually a very recalcitrant member. So he came in when he was first elected in 1946, and he beat Bartell Jonkman, who was the incumbent. So he beat an incumbent member, just like AOC did, just like some other members have done. And he beat him by running, in a sense, was to the left of the incumbent. Mm-hmm. Jonkman was a non-interventionist. He was very anti-government in many respects. Ford ran to the left. Ford basically ran to his left and said, "I'm going to be a better voice for the district." So he gets elected. Then when he gets elected, he eventually runs against, first of all, the sitting member who ran the Republican caucus,
mm-hmm.
and then he runs against the minority leader.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Halleck was the one who he had run against. And there was called the Young Turks, believe it or not.
Okay.
So there was an assemblage in the Republican Party led by a young Donald Rumsfeld, the future Secretary of Defense, who represented a congressional district in Illinois, and they were trying to get more youthful leadership. So Charlie Halleck, who had actually beaten Joe Martin from Massachusetts, Halleck had come in and beaten him and become minority leader. But there, you know, under his leadership, he was seen as kind of a passive type of a leader, although he was actually probably more conservative. They used to have a show called Everett Dirksen was the Republican minority leader from Illinois, and Halleck would come on, and they'd have a show they'd come on where they'd basically criticize what the President Kennedy, then for a little while President Johnson was doing, and they called it the Evan Charlie Show.
Mm.
So Ford runs against Charlie Halleck as an anti-establishment candidate, beats him, and then the show becomes the Evan Jerry Show, and they actually deliver the first the first response to the State of the Union address, which is Lyndon Johnson's address in 1966.
Oh, that's cool! So, I didn't know that.
Ford was seen as such an establishment guy. People say that Nixon chose him. They say, you know, he'd been there 25 years in Congress. He must have known everybody, but he had basically defeated three people who were members of the Republican establishment to take that position, and he becomes the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and ironically, Ford wasn't Nixon's first choice. His first choice was John Conley, the Treasury Secretary, who was the guy that was with John F. Kennedy when he was assassinated, the governor of Texas at the time,
okay.
Also a former Navy secretary. Well, he switched to the Democrat, to the Republican Party. He ran Democrats for Nixon in 1972 when George McGovern was the nominee, and then he supported Nixon. Nixon wanted him to become his choice, but the Democrats wouldn't accept him because they thought, well, he'd become Republican, and they thought he was a turncoat. And the Republicans said, well, the guy's really a Democrat. So So they said, so he went to Carol Albert, the Speaker of the House from Oklahoma, who was actually kind of a moderate member, moderate speaker. And he said, who would you choose? And he said, well, choose Gerald Ford. He's affected by everybody. So, you know, Ford was the minority leader. So he picked him, and Ford sailed through in the Senate. This was the first time for really when you actually needed rather congressional approval for somebody to become vice president because of the 25th Amendment. So Ford, and interestingly about the 25th Amendment, it was Carol Albert. It was Birch Bayh, rather, a senator from Indiana, that wrote it. And Birch Bayh recently died about a year ago in 1967, and he did that in part because there was no vacancy. When the president becomes president upon the death of a former president, there was nothing in the Constitution to allow him to choose his vice president.
Oh, okay.
So Lyndon Johnson, 63, was speaking right after Kennedy's death, and you saw right behind him, you saw John McCormick, the Speaker of the House, who was in his late 70s, and then you saw Carl Hayden from Arizona, this president pro temp, and he was in his 80s. And folks looked at that picture, and they thought, wow, you know, if President Johnson dies, one of these two will be president. Mm-hmm. These are the two people under the Constitution. It goes president and then vice president. If there's no vice president, it goes to the Speaker of the House. Not the Constitution, rather. That actually goes back to the Presidential Succession Act signed by President Truman in 1947. Mm-hmm. So it almost happened because the day that Kennedy was shot, President Johnson went back to his house, and someone thought it was an intruder, and a Secret Service agent actually had a gun that was pointed toward him.
Boy, wouldn't that have been crazy?
Can you imagine? Then the next president, well, supposedly, John McCormick had heard this story, and John McCormick, the Speaker of the House, was in his late 70s, who really was not prepared to be president. He supposedly fainted when he heard the story because someone thought, I'm going to be president now.
Oh, no. Well,
he was not.
That is crazy.
He was not prepared for that at all.
You think the succession line, you think it'll never happen. And then one major crazy event, the assassination of JFK, sets all of that in motion, and reality sets in that this very well could happen. And what's crazy about all of this, too, a Secret Service agent, everyone on edge, you know, they just look at the terrible, terrible events of the assassination of, you know, a president, and everyone's, I'm sure, thinking we got to really tighten things up. And, you know, they, I'm sure, were on edge, and they probably were overreacting, but out of the caution, overabundance of caution. So I can't imagine the new president of the United States walking into his own residence and a Secret Service agent pulls a gun. I wonder if that would have been covered up if something would have happened there.
You know, it's interesting. I guess this would be, you know, a great movie in terms of what happens. But what if, I mean, Speaker McCormick actually would have become president? So they put that. So what they did is they put the 25th Amendment in place, and it actually, it's fascinating how it worked. I mean, you know, you had other presidents, for example, William Henry Harrison died in 1841, 31 days into his presidency of pneumonia. John Tyler succeeds him. And then people were saying, well, is he the acting president or the president? And John Tyler says, I'm the president. So you had it again, you know, certainly when Lincoln, you had it many more times in history. Lincoln died, the vice president was Andrew Johnson. He had no vice president.
Yeah.
You know, certainly that. So that was kind of the precedent, you know, when Calvin Coolidge had no vice president until he actually was elected in his own right. Then he chose Charles W. Dawes in 1925, and he actually became his vice. So he became vice president. But in that little interim, there was no vice president.
Yeah. By the way, the people that can memorize and know all of the presidents of the United States in order, can you do that with the vice presidents? Are you that knowledgeable?
I think so.
Whoa! See, that's the memory on you. That's what I'm talking about.
I think I could probably do that, but it would probably take me a little while.
Yeah, you might have to use a pen and paper to, you know, help track, because there's a lot of names. And I got to also, if I were to wager, if we did one of those man on the street segments where we said, I want you to name 10 vice presidents, most people wouldn't be able to do it. You know, just because it's hard. You can think of the most recent vice presidents. You might be able to go back to the 1980s. And then after that, there's going to be some names in there that you're not going to be able to remember.
But of course, everyone would know who Garrett Hobart is.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Everyone knows Hobart. Well, you mentioned Harry Truman. I learned something from you on Facebook that the S in Harry S. Truman is not an initial for his middle name. That's fascinating.
Oh, no, absolutely not. That is fascinating. it's funny because, you know, basically, and there's actually an issue in the Truman community, I guess you'd call it.
The Truman community.
There is a Truman community. I'm sure they're in Lamar, Missouri, probably in Independence, Missouri.
Yeah, can I say that that's a much better name than the Squad? If they can come up with the Truman community or something along those lines, much better than naming yourself the Squad. But, you know, of course, Harry S. Truman is the only president out of Missouri, very well respected here inside of the state. So I was hoping that you can tell that story where the S came from in Harry S. Truman.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's fascinating. So basically he did not have a middle name, but he had two grandfathers, and both of their grandfathers, their first name began with an S. So he had, one of them was Ship Truman and the other one was Solomon Young. So they put an S basically for his middle initial, an S. But now there's a question though, if you don't have a last name, do you have to put a period? For example, you know, if it's Lyndon B. Johnson, you put Lyndon B. period Johnson, and that would be standard operating procedure. So the S does not stand for a name, but actually Truman himself actually used the S in his signature. So some people, there is an argument. I mean, it's really a contentious, you know, these are the important issues that we have to deal with in our times. you know, it hasn't caused bloodshed yet, but I'm sure between some grammarians maybe. But there is a debate within the community between what, you know, Truman himself did it. But some people say grammatically that he shouldn't have, that there should not be a period there. So it actually became an issue, and it's fascinating because in my first book, the first book I wrote about little known facts in American politics, and somebody wrote an Amazon review. This is not somebody, not an official person. This is just somebody, some random guy who got the book, and he said, and he actually pointed this out, and he said that that there's a big problem in the book that I keep seeing periods after the S in Truman. And Harry S. Truman, and someone actually wrote a complaint about that.
Oh, interesting.
So, he actually found my personal email address and wrote it to me. So this guy was really offended. he obviously has a lot of important things going on in his life.
Yes, obviously.
I didn't respond to it, but it got me to thinking, so I went to the Truman Library site, and I typed this in. I'm thinking, you know, is this right? And the Truman Library, they contend that there should be a period there.
Oh, interesting.
There are a lot of, you know, important issues in our time, and, you know, this has got to be number three or four right up there.
I think there should be a full round of debates on CNN to talk about this. We'll bring in the pros and cons. We'll do a town hall setting, and everyone will just definitively figure out if there should be a period there or not.
Well, you know what? I bet Elizabeth Warren will say, I have a plan for that.
All right. American Politics on the Rocks, The Bizarre Side of American Politics. Your book is on Amazon, right? People can find it right there?
Yep, and every time you see an S in a Truman, there's going to be a period there, and if you want to complain about it, go right ahead.
All right, and since it is time for everyone to go on Amazon, it's Amazon Prime. This is
everyone
should do. Just go look up American Politics on the Rocks by Rich Rubino, add it to your cart, and just throw it in with all of your other Amazon Prime purchases. This is a good opportunity to get it. Rich Rubino, I love having you on Mondays. Thank you for coming on to KMOX.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you so much.
We also podcast these at KMOX.com/ONA. And if you like this one, go back and listen to some of the other ones we've had every Monday night. This is Overnight America, KMOX. We're going to have quite a show Wednesday night at 10 o'clock. Oh, boy. We're actually going to have two Border Patrol agents join us live. And during that 10 o'clock hour, they said, yes, we'll take questions. So if you wanted to call in and talk to actual Border Patrol agents about what really goes on at the United States border with Mexico, that'll happen on Wednesday night. Oh, we got some interesting ones tomorrow. We have a guest tomorrow night that is someone that wrote a book about how they help the teachers in the different schools approach the topic of 9/11. If you think about it, if you're in school right now, you probably were born after 9/11. You have no memory or so a lot of times you don't even know what 9/11 is. You know, I've read these stories online where students will be inside of a classroom and a teacher will bring up September 11, 2001, and then the class will say, oh, we just thought that was something that was in a movie. We didn't know that was real. Like, they didn't understand that's part of American history. And they found out that a lot of teachers are just skipping that as part of history. They're not covering that in classes. Isn't that crazy? So we're going to talk to a person tomorrow that wrote a book in hopes to help different teachers tackle this subject so it is taught in schools. So we're going to do that tomorrow night. We got a lot to get to on the show tomorrow. Wow. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Ryan Recker. And if you miss any part of the show, you can download it by going to KMOX.com/ONA. I don't know why so many people are taking this seriously, but I reached out to some of my conspiracy friends. Oh, I got a few. We've had them on here. Dave Scott from Space Dot Radio. He does a podcast and a radio program. His show's actually broadcasted. He's based out of the Vancouver area and is not Drex. It is someone different from Canada. And he is someone that talks about these paranormal different stories, and he's also someone that likes to talk about what's going on in the United States. Area 51 is still a very big hotbed of, you know, people wondering what's going on there. And I asked him about this petition where people are signing up to raid Area 51 or storm Area 51. And I asked him about it, and I said, I don't get it. Are people serious about this? Is this something that's big in the UFO community? They feel like they have to go raid Area 51? And he said, no. He said, this is absolutely crazy. He said, the sad thing is there's going to be about a dozen people that don't know any better that are absolutely nuts, and they're going to try and get themselves killed. That's the sad thing. So what's going to start off as a joke is going to end with someone getting themselves killed for doing this. So if you don't know about this, more than a million people now have signed up to raid Area 51 to hunt for aliens. The joke event was posted, and people kept signing up. They thought it was hilarious. They said, oh, I want to do that. I want to do that. I want to do that. They set it for 3 a.m. on September 20th in the desert in Nevada, and they're going to meet close to the location. They're going to figure out how they're going to approach it, and then they said they're going to go approach it. Facebook post says, they can't stop us all. The raid would be quite a sight. It says, quote, we can move faster than their bullets. It participates, join this. Is it Naruto Run, the Japanese manga-inspired style per CNN that involves running with arms outstretched behind and heads forward? Okay, I guess that's one way to do it. There's going to be some people that take this seriously. You know, they'll give it a shot and get shot. A lot of people have been joking about this online. You may have seen the memes go around. It's actually pretty funny. You know, oh, how I'm going to approach this. And then people will post certain clips. Like, for example, it shows a picture of my motivation to study versus my motivation to get into Area 51. You know, it shows one where one's procrastinating, just sitting there thinking, and the other one about going absolutely crazy, jumping into this sort of thing. If anyone thinks that this is how it's going to work, that they're just going to, you know, make their way in and, you know, they're going to find a way to get all of the secrets at Area 51, you're nuts. And I'm sorry. So we got September 20th, which is a date that, wow, I mean, it's July 16th, 2019, yeah. I mean, you're just a couple of months away. You're getting pretty close. And more people are going to sign up for sure. But keep in mind, this was started as a joke. This was started not for a way to be serious. They're trolling. It's a way to troll people. And that's how a lot of these online things start. And then people take it out of on themselves. Like, think about all of these viral trends that have turned dangerous, like stupid kids putting Tide Pods in their mouth, even though it might be a very few amount of people that actually participate in some of these stupid ideas that start online. There's still a couple of people that do it because they think, oh man, this is how I'm going to get recognition. This is how I'm going to be remembered for. I'll be the person that stormed Area 51. Now, the Air Force has already said, oh, we'll be there. We'll be waiting for them. They're not going to play around with these people that do this, tinfoil hat and all. So we'll see how that plays out. We're still a couple of months away. I like that they point out that there's a lot of air, like right now, if you were to go online and try to book a flight around that time to Area 51, or at least around there to Nevada, flights are booked up. You can't get on anymore. So they're saying, what if people actually do show up? Then what happens? Is this organizer going to find himself, or herself, I should say, it's a female organizer, herself, are they going to find that they're going to be responsible for drumming up and getting people all started up in this hoax? Boy, oh boy. This is Overnight America, KMOX. Some of the late night shows that are running on the networks, like I'm watching CNN right now, and or not CNN, CBS, and they're running some of their
their pieces on the Apollo 11 launch day anniversary. So 50 years ago, July 16th, 1969, was the launch day for Apollo 11. And 4 days later, on July 20th, that's when Neil Armstrong would first plant his feet on the moon. Really remarkable. Here is CBS reporting. Peter King.
This is Apollo Saturn launch control.
NASA engineer and future shuttle launch director Bob Sieg was one of hundreds of thousands watching from Titusville near the Kennedy Space Center, where many had been camped out for days.
There was pup tents pitched everywhere. Traffic was just essentially stopped. People had just parked the cars on the highway. We're sitting on the roof or on the hood or whatever.
He says people were listening to the radio and watching as the countdown clock hit zero. Usually,
you can hear a Saturn V from miles away. Well, you couldn't hear it over there for the roar of the people and the horns blaring.
Peter King, CBS News at the Kennedy Space Center.
That's actually really cool. I would think about some of those historic moments I wish I could have lived for myself, and that would have been one. Could you imagine? Now, if we send people back to the moon, that's going to be a pretty significant day for sure. Everyone's going to be watching it. That is something that's significant. I don't know if I would drive down to Florida to watch it or anything like that, but what I would do, definitely watch it on TV. And that's something I would love to do with my son someday. I know a lot of people have done that. They traveled down with family members all the way to Florida to watch a space launch, and man, would that be an awesome experience. The closest I got was up in Michigan. I went to one of the 3D IMAX shows where they did the space presentation. So you put on the glasses, you have to turn it on. The glasses are battery powered, but you watch these things, and they had a video of this launch. And it's like you could reach out and touch this stuff the way the 3D works. It was pretty remarkable. And I thought, oh man, I got to go witness this someday for my own. It was just really, really cool. So as we get closer to that, yeah, we're going to have more and we'll talk about it more. But if you actually witness that, this is one of the things that most remarkable moments you'll ever witness in your life was that Apollo 11 launch and then landing on the moon for the first time, watching that with all of the world. Really remarkable. Really, really remarkable. I wonder if the conspiracy theorists are going to be out in full force, the ones that don't believe we went to the moon. You know, I wonder if they're going to be out really trying to push their message. This is like the right time for them, the 50th anniversary of it. Too bad Neil Armstrong's not around anymore. Too bad. When did he die? 10 years ago? 8 years ago? Something like that? Doesn't seem like it was too long ago. I got a couple of other stories before we say goodnight, and we'll be back again tomorrow after Cardinals baseball. They got another one of those, later starts. Well, regular start times here in St. Louis, a home game. Which means we probably won't be on until about, 11 o'clock again. So we'll get as much as we can out when we can. Wednesday's an early game, so we don't have to worry about it. I'm really looking forward to Wednesday. We're going to have two Border Patrol agents, people that are on the ground. They'll tell us their experiences working the border. Man, that's going to be an awesome, awesome Wednesday night, which I'm glad they agreed to take phone calls. So if anyone has questions of what goes on, that'll be a great opportunity for you to do that. The Illinois Department of Transportation wants to know more about what they call Def Leppard Lagoon. I found this on Fox 2. They're asking their Facebook fans to verify the name of a lagoon located in northern Illinois. It says, we're double-checking a location on the map and stumbled upon this interesting place. Southwest Peotone says, does anyone have a photograph? Photograph, capital P, meaning the song, the Def Leppard song. Photograph of this, or is this map just fooling? I see another Def Leppard joke. Def Leppard is, of course, the name of, when they look at this Def Leppard Lagoon. It says the post is to a forum. It shed some light on the area. It says you can find it, but I don't think you can find it by Googling it for its phrase. It just happens to be in a spot that's on a fishing map that people find out. And, every once in a while, if you search for it, you can find certain things like that. It's a small spot on the Rock Creek as it passes under South Center Road, southwest of Peotone. Don't know that area all that much, but man, I think that's hilarious. Every once in a while, people will post things on Google Maps that are inaccurate, but people have the freedom to do that. You can go online and say, oh, no, this is the business or this is that. And Google doesn't know any better when it comes to these small places that have no connection to anything else. They just roll with it. It's that town, you've heard the term paper towns, right? So this is a pretty well-known story. If you haven't heard this, you probably will remember this, just like everyone else has remembered it. So back in the day when there were map makers, and they're still map makers, but, you know, back when they were actively making maps, they would, and by the way, I guess people still do this, they'll put something, an inaccurate something inside of the map that they're creating. Normally, it's something that's minor. It doesn't really mess up with anyone. Like, sometimes people will add a road where there's no road, or sometimes people will add a store or a turn or, you know, something or a creek or whatever it is that's actually not there. And what they do is they do that to deter people from stealing the map that they just put all this time and effort into. So if there's another map that pops up and the thing that they put in there that's fake shows up, they can say, hold on, right here, see, we made this up. That means they stole our map, so we're allowed to sue them. And that happened one time. A map maker went in and they put in a town that didn't exist. I think it was in Pennsylvania or something, but it was a really small town in the middle of nowhere. And this map maker decided to put a fake town there. And then later, they found that fake town on another map. And they were sued and taken to court. And they defended themselves. And they said, this place actually exists. They took photographs. Here's the sign. Here's this and that. As it turns out, when this fake map came out, the people that bought this map just assumed, oh, okay, this is the little town. This is what this area is called. So without forming a government or anything, it just became that. It just manifested as this fake little town. A couple of stores came up and, you know, gas stations or whatever. And next thing you know, the people that lived there just started calling it that fake town that that map maker created. And ultimately, that's what the term paper towns, what they do to deter people stealing their intellectual property or whatever. It's kind of a cool little story, isn't it? I'm not doing it justice. It's actually a much cooler story than what I'm saying, but that'll have to do for 2 a.m. on a now Tuesday morning. I want you to enjoy the rest of your night. We'll be back again after Cardinals baseball. Don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker. Better yet, download the podcast. Support us that way. And tell your friends about it. Send links to your friends. Go to KMOX.com/ONA and give us a nice 5-star review. That helps a lot. We'll see you later. Bye.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.